The following program is intended as an educational program, not as investment advice or as a recommendation to buy, sell, or participate in any investment vehicle, product, offering, or strategy. Investment advisory services are offered through Turning Point Financial, a registered investment advisor. Any references to specific securities, investment vehicles, or strategies are intended only as examples, not as recommendations. All investments involve risk, including the possibility of losing money. Welcome to Money in Mission, where each week we talk about wealth management built on a foundation of biblical wisdom and principles. Do you ever wonder how your money and the stuff you own are actually helping you live out what you really feel called to in your heart? You know, there's so much peace of mind when you sense that your money is aligned with your values and convictions, as well as your financial goals. And there really, really is peace of mind when you know that there's alignment there, that your financial goals are in sync with your values and convictions. There's when that doesn't happen, there's just this enormous opportunity for anxiety when you can just sense that that alignment doesn't happen. And when you're confused or scared, you simply don't make good decisions. And that can keep you from being all that God wants you to be. And it can hurt you pretty badly as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, welcome to episode
18. Yes.
Money and Mission. I'm James Good.
And I am Eric Terrio. Each week in the first part of our show, we will talk about some current financial events. You'll have a better understanding of what some of the terminology and events actually mean.
Yeah, and part of the way through the show, then we get to our weekly puzzler.
Mm-hmm.
I love the weekly weekly puzzler. I wish I could get that out. We'll share that with you. It's a brain teaser. We don't know really if the weekly puzzler is actually interesting. Every time I share it with Joe here, he's like, get a day job, James.
Lately, there's been some facepalms.
That's right. So anyway, but we hope it'll be interesting. These are little riddles that we enjoy, and we'll share that with you part of the way through the show.
That's right. So let's jump into our week in review. So, James, what did you think? I think I know, but was a recent financial news highlight from this past week.
Well, what do you think? What do you think? You said you think you know. So what do you think?
I think it's the big announcement everyone's been waiting for about the Fed.
That's right.
What they were going to do with rates.
That's right. You know, today is Thursday. Today is Thursday, September 19th.
That's right.
And yesterday afternoon, the Fed, you know, made the announcement that it felt like everybody was waiting for all year long. Except I think the Fed surprised everybody yesterday.
Yeah.
They did a 50 basis point rate cut.
Yeah. I mean, a rate cut is what almost everyone expected the Fed to do.
Yeah, but 50 basis points. And then they kind of signaled that later in the year they might do another quarter of a point. And mm-hmm. later yet this year, they might do another quarter of a point, which, mm-hmm. which is like a whole percentage rate cut.
Yeah.
In a really, really short period of time. That kind of, you know, when you do something, typically when the Fed has a history of doing rate changes at a quarter of a point at a time, to all of a sudden have an entire percentage rate change in such a short period of time, it just kind of sends a message that makes everybody nervous. Like, what do you know that we don't?
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, they have that, you know, that delicate balancing act that they have between fighting inflation and supporting economic growth.
That's right. But we've been, you know, we've been talking here on the podcast for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're on like episode 18. So for the last couple of months, we've been talking about the fact that there are recessionary type pressures going on, the purchasing managers index and so on and so forth. So the Fed hears, you know, saying that, hey, we think this rate cut is going to head off a recession. And I think we may already be in a recession. And they're talking about heading it off. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing that nobody, it seemed like, I haven't seen any headlines on this anyway, that anyone's really talking about is the Fed's balance sheet. And the balance sheet really is any balance sheet is a list of assets, things that someone or a business owns.
Sure.
Right. And the Fed really is no different. The Fed's balance sheet consists of assets that the Fed owns. But we really need to think this through together to understand exactly what that means. So it's a tool, the balance sheet is a tool that the Fed uses for influencing long-term interest rates and the money supply.
Yes.
And that, you know, I want to create like a little analogy here or a word picture that can kind of help our listeners to really understand what exactly that means when the Fed increases or decreases its balance sheet. Like, how does that work exactly? So the Fed has a committee. Churches have committees too, don't they?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they do, yes.
That's right. We always wonder, you know, all these committees got together. Anyway, so I digress. The Fed has this committee called the Federal Open Market Committee, or the FOMC. And basically what the Federal Open Market Committee does periodically is it buys bonds from the market. So really, picture two buckets, right? In one bucket, we're going to say this bucket is the economy. And this bucket represents all the cash that's in the economy and the bonds that are in the economy and the stocks and really all of the assets that are in the economy. And there's a certain amount of cash. So businesses, individuals, people can use that cash. And when the cash is all gone, it's all gone, right? But when the Fed buys a bond from the economy, then we have to kind of enter bucket number two. Bucket number two is the Fed's balance sheet. So the Fed sends cash. When the Fed buys a bond from bucket number one, the economy, the Fed sends cash to that bucket. And a bond goes from bucket number one, the economy, to bucket number two, the Fed's balance sheet.
Mm.
So you can picture that.
So that's tightening, right?
Well, no, that's loosening.
Oh, removing money from the economy?
Well, adding money to the economy.
Oh, sorry. Right. Misunderstood.
So an asset got purchased so the Fed's balance sheet increased. And when the Fed's balance sheet increases, then it's called easing, or it makes more cash available. But tightening works the other way, right? When the Fed either sells a bond back in, well, when the Fed sells a bond back into the economy, then it removes cash. And so then the money supply decreases. So that's right. But this is the truest definition of inflation, that you expand the money supply or expand purchasing power. So nobody's really talking about the Fed's balance sheet. And it would seem to me that if rates were such a big deal in terms of either fighting inflation or fighting recession or whatever, that somehow someone would be talking as well about the balance sheet. So, you know, we went out and looked at the balance sheet. And you can actually go out to the Federal Reserve website and just, there's a neat little chart on the Fed's balance sheet or the Fed's website that has its balance sheet. And what we see really from about mid-year, from about July of 2022, the balance sheet has been declining. Which means that either the amount of money in the economy is staying the same or it's been getting less.
Mm.
So the Fed's been either tightening or holding things steady for, you know, since July of 2022.
So if we're looking at a chart of the Fed's balance sheet and the chart is going up, basically the Fed is increasing money supply, correct?
Yes.
Mm.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. exactly right.
Yep.
And that's very inflationary.
Sure.
But if the Fed is, if the balance sheet is decreasing, then really it's either neutral or tightening.
Mm-hmm.
So one really has to, these two are fighting each other. The Fed reduces interest rates, but the balance sheet is continuing to decline, at least for now. Right. I think that's really something we want to keep an eye on, because if the balance sheet starts to increase again, then we're back to whatever the Fed used to call quantitative easing. But that's just, you know, inflation in great big capital letters.
Mm-hmm.
It also means probably that the government is borrowing more money, which we know that is absolutely happening.
And not slowing down.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that next week. Back to that same old topic again. But, you know, looking back through history, we see increases in the Fed's balance sheet at the beginning of 2009, right as we were coming out of the 2008 recession. We saw a increase in the balance sheet again in 2013. We saw an increase from 2020 up until about June of 2022. So, you know, so we've had these periods of increasing Fed balance sheet and increasing money supply in a pretty big way.
And then rate hikes through the past few years.
And then rate hikes for the past 3 years.
Which they both aim to tighten, you know, structure monetary policy, right? But in different ways.
In different
ways. One's removing money from the economy. The other is making it harder to borrow money by raising the interest rates.
That's correct. You know, in July of 2007, the Fed's balance sheet, for all the up and down, right? In July of 2007, the Fed's balance sheet was about $870 billion, with a B. Today, even after a year and a half of declining balance sheet, the Fed's balance sheet still stands at about $7 trillion.
Mm.
So there's been this huge, enormous expansion of the balance sheet, which means an enormous expansion of the money supply.
And a massive amount of inflation.
That is the reason we have inflation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you're going to get rid of inflation by just, well, they just cut rates. Right? So stay tuned. Here we go again. The problem, of course, is that we've all gotten used to an expanding money supply. There seems to be more and more money to go around, but we know money just doesn't grow on trees. So, the net bottom line is people should make sure that their investments, their business plans, their personal financial plans should be positioned in a way that can get through a period of time, possibly where the money supply is not expanding and a completely different environment than what we've been used to for the last 10 or 15 years.
We're all out of time. We need to take a break. Stay tuned. You're listening to Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio.
Welcome back to Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720, where each week we talk about wealth management built on a foundation of biblical wisdom and principles. I'm James.
And this is Eric.
And we're co-hosting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Episode 18.
Episode 18. That's right. If you only remember one thing from our conversation today, we hope you'll remember that IRAs are a tool,
mm-hmm.
right? A financial tool. They're intended to hold money that is saved for retirement, as opposed to some other things that people could be doing with their IRAs. But IRAs are a tool. And, you know, I think we had a listener who had said, you know, I'd really like to hear some things about IRAs.
Yeah, so let's break it down for our listeners, James. What exactly is an IRA?
Let's talk about that. But I think I first of all want to just note that at last check, the IRS has these publications that talk about IRAs. And I think in total,
they're good bedtime stories.
They're good. Yeah, that's right.
Put you to sleep.
If you have trouble sleeping at night, you want to dig these out and read through them in detail, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they total 130 pages altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, you know, this is a topic that is going to get very complicated very quickly. But we did have that listener who had said to us, hey, you know, could you guys talk about IRAs? And because I, you know, I don't think some of the people that we referenced here on the podcast have, that they had IRAs, like the Ursuline sisters.
I think it was a little predated them.
It was a little, yeah.
Yeah.
The Ursuline sisters, but they had other financial tools.
Sure.
Right? I mean, Mother Teresa probably doesn't have an IRA, didn't have an IRA.
I'm sure they had an individual retirement account in a sense, but not, wasn't going through the IRS.
Not in the same way that we think about it here today. So, you know, back to my earlier comment that an IRA is a tool.
That's right.
It's one of those things that details change around us as tax law changes and the economy that we live in change. The details may change, but the principles that we're talking about are really unchanging.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those principles can be applied, you know, to an IRA or to any other types of investment accounts that people might have.
And like you said, it's a tool, right? Just a tool in the tool belt.
That's
right.
It's
not the end all, be all of saving, but when done well with proper planning.
That's right. That's right. And so we're gonna dig into that a little bit here. Just because of the complexity of the topic, we're not going to have time to do more than a broad brush overview of some IRA topics here today. But we'll try to add, we'll try to cover more on this topic as we go forward too. So, but because of the complexity, I was thinking we could probably talk for the rest of the month on this topic. Joe, could we like talk all afternoon today?
No.
See, I actually wrote that down here on our script. Joe is going to say no. Somehow.
I didn't have a script.
Yeah, Joe didn't even have a script. That's right. So, So I'm sorry. Back to your question. We really went down a little tangent there. What exactly is an IRA?
Right.
Right.
Let's start at step one.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and it's an individual retirement account. And you know, when I was first learning the business, a little over 30 years ago, there were references to an individual retirement annuity as well. But I think the most general way of thinking about an IRA is that it's an individual retirement account. And IRAs were first introduced. We'll cover some history here, right? But IRAs were first.
Went through some changes.
Mm-hmm. First introduced in the United States in 1974. And the whole point at the time was to have a tax-preferred savings vehicle. Congress was reportedly concerned that people who didn't have access to pensions would have a savings vehicle that could help them save up money for retirement years. So that's where this whole thing got started.
So outside of the workplace, you can have your own account.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. And remember back in the 70s, pensions were really, really big deal.
I remember my grandparents had pensions from the American Can Company in Baltimore, but they've since went out of business.
Yeah, yeah. And my dad was actually a truck driver and you know, he was a Teamster, and the company that he worked for had some kind of pension as well.
Because it's weird. As a little kid, I wondered how they kept bringing in money. They never left the house.
Yeah, that's right. The check just kept right on rolling. But that's what pensions were all about. But not everybody had a pension. And so Congress created this tax-preferred savings vehicle called an individual retirement account. And originally, everybody who was working, everybody who was drawing a paycheck and had a W-2 could make tax-deductible contributions into an IRA all the way up until their age 70 and a half. So IRAs were originally set up so that everybody could make a contribution and have it be tax-deductible. When you have a tax-deductible contribution, the way that works, let's pretend you have $100,000 of income and you would contribute $2,000 to a tax-deductible IRA.
Okay.
Well, after you did that, then instead of having $100,000 of taxable income, you would only have $98,000 of taxable income.
Mm-hmm.
So your contribution would be tax-deductible mm-hmm. in that way. It would reduce your taxable income.
For that year.
For that year.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. So that has implications, right? Now you've put money in this bucket or this box or whatever represented by the individual retirement account, and you received a tax deduction. So that means that—
Does that mean you pay taxes on it later? Or?
Later.
Yes.
Yeah, which is tax deferred,
mm-hmm.
right? Remember, I mean, the key word there is defer.
Not tax-free.
No, you put it off until a later date, a later date in time. So
Which is still very beneficial.
Which is still beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. But it's not, you're not getting away from it.
Right?
You're putting it off until a later time.
Uncle Sam wants it in or out.
That's right. So then what happens, though, is whoever receives that money at that later time then is responsible to pay taxes on that money at whatever tax rate they happen to be in the year they get the money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as time has gone along, we have everybody sits and tries to figure out, am I paying more taxes now or will I be paying more taxes later? Right. And there's a lot of moving parts.
It sounds like it can get complicated.
So that's right.
Let's sounds talk like about we, some of the history of IRAs.
Yeah, let's do that. But it sounds like a topic for, you know, one of the CPAs we know.
Yeah, we'll bring them on.
We'll have to bring some folks.
Or a little Q&A session for one segment.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry, what was the question? Oh, history.
Yeah, let's go over the history of it.
Right. So, yeah, we said 1974, this little tiny section of the tax code called ERISA. That was a joke. ERISA is not a tiny little section. It's like hundreds of pages long. So ERISA established these IRAs, again, as a tax-preferred savings option for people without pension. And initially, the contribution limit, like the most that anybody could contribute each year, was $1,500.
That was the maximum.
That's right.
But it was in the 70s.
So. Back in the 70s.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So that was 74. So fast forward, right, flip the pages on the calendar, and we get to 1981.
So about 7 years later.
Right. It's funny how it doesn't take many years to start changing things.
No.
Right? I mean, we put this little solution in place or this thing, and all of a sudden a little bit of time goes by, and it's like, hey, let's start making some changes. So the Economic Recovery Act expanded IRA availability and deductibility to all workers and their spouses.
Oh, wow.
Right. So now, you know, if I'm employed but my wife isn't, prior to that, she could not have made an IRA contribution, but now she could as a quote-unquote spousal contribution. So, and the contribution in 1981, the limit was increased to $2,000 per year.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we're going to run out of time here in this segment, so.
Yeah, let's just go a little farther and we'll finish up in the next one.
Yeah, we'll finish up history in the next one, right. 1986 rolls around and there are more changes, right? Is that like 7 years later? From 1974 Five. To 1981 was 7 years?
Oh, yes.
And mm-hmm. then from there to 1986,
mm-hmm.
seven more years goes by. I'm not sure if there's anything magic about the number seven, but—
That's five.
That Oh, true. So it is. That's right. Okay.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop.
I think we should stop.
How about we get to the weekly puzzler?
Yeah, let's do that. And we'll come back to IRA history after the weekly puzzle.
Okay. So let's get to last week's puzzlers. And that was, there is one in every corner and two in every room. One in every corner and two in every room. Did you have any ideas, Joe? No.
Not that one.
All right. Letter O.
Oh.
Oh, the letter O. One in every corner.
Corners, 1-0. Room has 2-0s.
Two in every room. Yeah.
I see how they got there.
Except the room has 4 corners.
It does. That's what I was initially thinking when I heard it.
Unless it's a round room.
Okay.
All right. Never mind. We have to get to this week's puzzle.
That's why these are James' favorites.
That's right. These fall under the dad jokes. This week's puzzle, my first is nothing but a name. My second is less. My whole is of so little fame, it has no name at all. What am I?
My first is nothing but a name. My second is less. My whole is of so little fame, it has no name at all. What am I?
Yeah. Send your responses to radiopuzzles at radiopuzzle@wealthdevelopmentcouncil.com. You're listening to Holy Family Radio, and we'll be back after a couple of notes.
That's right.
That's right. Welcome back to Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720, where each week we talk about wealth management built on a foundation of biblical principles and biblical wisdom. I'm James.
And this is Eric.
And we are talking today.
Yeah, let's jump back into the history of individual retirement accounts.
Individual retirement accounts, one of my favorite topics.
That's right.
That's right.
So we got through the inception.
That's right.
And then a couple of the changes through 81, and now we're up to 1986.
1986. So in 1986, you had the Tax Reform Act, and that started phasing out the deductibility of IRA contributions based on household income and employer-sponsored pension coverage.
Phasing out the deductibility. Wow, that's a big year for it.
Yeah.
It's a big change.
So, you know, prior to that, or when IRAs were first set up, anybody could put money into an IRA and they could deduct that money.
100% of it.
100% of it from their taxable income. And now, in 1986, you have a rule introduced that says if you earn more than a certain amount and you have a pension at work, then your ability to deduct your contributions from your income is going to start phasing out. It's going to get less and less until, depending on your income, you may not get any tax deduction at all. And that really kind of created what was eventually became dubbed as the non-deductible IRA, right? Which is not really a different kind of IRA. It's about the tax treatment of the contributions.
And then it looks like they didn't make any changes for a little while, at least a decade.
That's right. That's right. A lot of years go by. Wow. You know, first we're making changes to this every couple of years. And then, like in 97, you had Senators William Roth and Bob Packwood, who introduced, drum roll,
the Roth IRA.
That's right. It's like Senator Roth needed his name on something. And
what happened to Bob? He got cut out.
He did.
Not the Packwood IRA.
Or the Roth Packwood.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, we name streets after people. Why shouldn't we name, I don't know. If I was Bob Packwood, I would feel kind of
slighted.
That's right. So, but anyway, these guys came up with the idea that a retirement account should have tax-free withdrawals on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was probably very popular.
But again, Uncle Sam wants it in or out.
In or out. That's right. So,
to get the money tax free on the end, you had to have used.
You had to give up something on the front.
Mm-hmm. Taxed dollars already.
That's right.
To put into it.
That's right. So basically, a Roth IRA really didn't. It didn't actually get into the tax code for another year but they started kicking this idea around and eventually came up with the Roth IRA, where they said, okay, you can make anybody, you know, you can make a contribution to this IRA, but we're not going to give you a tax deduction when you put money in.
Gotcha.
So now you have $100,000 of income in our example, and you make a $2,000 contribution to a Roth IRA, you still have $100,000 of taxable income. So your income is not reduced for the IRA contribution. But then, as long as you follow the rules on the back end, if the money is in your Roth IRA for at least 5 years and you're over the age of 59 and a half, then you can take all the money out, growth included, and not have to count any of it as taxable.
Mm-hmm.
So you gave up the tax deduction on the front end, and you got a very tax favorable income stream on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, so that was Senator Roth's idea. And that's probably, I mean, that was a game changer in terms of how IRAs were treated. And at some level, it kind of opened up a Pandora's box, because then people started coming up with different purposes, different things that you could start doing with IRAs. We'll talk a little bit about that here as we go. So initially there were income limits that restricted taxpayers. Oh, as soon as this Roth IRA was set up, then you had people trying to figure out, okay, I already put money into this tax deductible IRA, and I now have this bucket of money sitting there that is going to all be taxed at one point. And I would sure love to get the money from there over into a bucket where it wouldn't be taxed on the back. So I guess everybody starts trying to figure out how to convert their, that's what they call it, converting their IRA to a Roth IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's just something appealing about being able to have money that is never taxed.
Mm-hmm. And we do help folks with that, yeah.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah,
that's right. We try to help that. We try to help clients with that in our practice. So, but anyway, initially there were income limits which restricted taxpayers with in. So, if you were a taxpayer and your income went over $100,000, then you were not allowed to convert from an IRA to a Roth IRA.
Mm-hmm.
But initially, the way the rule worked was that the $100,000 included the money that was being converted. So that got really messy really quickly.
Hmm.
So what would happen? Let's just kind of put this on for size, right? Let's say you have $90,000 of income and you would convert from an IRA to a Roth IRA, and you wanted to give yourself a little bit of room. So you said, all right, I'm going to convert $8,000 this year. Now you would have a $98,000 income. And then what would happen if at the tail end of the year, your employer was like, hey, guess what? We're going to give you a bonus.
Ooh.
And all of a sudden you'd be over $100,000, and then your IRA conversion would be disallowed.
Mm-hmm.
What a mess. Mm. What a mess. So people had to be really careful, and then they had to go through all kinds of things like, recharacterizing the conversion that they had just made. And it really was. It was kind of a mess for people who were right on that threshold.
Yeah, I can imagine.
The change in that comes later. You know, Congress put this in place, and initially it was just kind of messy like that. But then in 2001, a law came along that linked the contribution limits to IRAs. It linked that to inflation.
Mm. So you can be able to contribute more each year.
That's right.
As inflation goes up.
That's right.
And hopefully wages go up.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where, you know, financial advisors and CPAs and anybody who had like memorized how much money could be contributed
went out the window.
Went out the window, yeah. Because it started to change every single year. And it just, as soon as you knew, thought you knew what it, you know, what the limit was, then it would change and it would be different. So, but the limit was linked to inflation. And we all know how the government loves to just be honest about inflation,
mm-hmm.
right?
And the revisions.
And the revisions, which the answer is not. So initially, the contribution limits didn't really increase that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to tell you, over the last couple of years, arguably, we've had much higher inflation. So one would think that those IRA contribution limits would have really been jacked up to reflect higher inflation.
Yeah, I guess we don't know exactly how they're linked, but...
But yeah, that's true. But in any case, the contribution limits started rising to because it was linked to inflation. And then in 2002...
So the following year.
The following year,
mm-hmm.
changes are coming fast and furious now. Mm-hmm. A catch-up contribution was put in place.
Well, that's a good change, though.
I guess that's a good change.
Yeah, being able to put more in there if you're over 50.
You're over 50.
Don't have much time left to save as you would if you were 30.
That's right.
You can stuff an extra 1,000 in there.
Then you can try to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. You know, we understand the power of compounding.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I mean, if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, oh, cool, you know, we can catch up. You can never go back and really capture the effects of compounding.
Right.
Right. Now, if you're over 50 and you haven't been saving, I mean, don't let the fact that you can't go back and capture the effects of compounding, don't let that stop you from doing the right thing now. But catching up is not the same as getting started early.
No.
At all. Okay. Little tangent there. 2005 rolls around, right? And now the Tax Increase Prevention and Reconciliation Act.
Mm-hmm.
I love the names they come up with for these different tax laws. It eliminated the income restriction on converting traditional IRAs to Roth IRAs.
Okay.
So not anybody could.
No matter what set your salary is,
right.
You're allowed to convert from the original IRA, which we call a traditional.
That's right.
So to the Roth.
To the Roth, mm-hmm. right. And not just your salary, but your income altogether. So let's pretend you had, you know, $1 million of income and you had $1 million in an IRA that you were going to convert, and maybe you had income coming from a business. I mean, so you've got many millions of dollars of not just salary, but income from all different sources,
mm-hmm.
and you would be able to convert. You'd have to pay taxes on the amount that you convert, but still you would be able to convert that IRA to a Roth IRA in pursuit of that tax-free income at later years of life.
Hmm. Well, since we talked about the history of IRAs, and as we discussed this, we talked about two different kinds of IRAs.
Mm-hmm.
Are there more kind of IRAs that we mentioned already?
There are.
Yeah.
And let's try to – we'll just run down through these really briefly because I think we have about 45 seconds left in this segment. But, yeah, so we have traditional IRAs and Roth IRAs and education IRAs – and SEP IRAs, and simple IRAs, and SARSEP IRAs, sorry, Joe, and beneficiary IRAs. There will be a quiz on this later.
Yeah, well, I have some questions on those as well, but you're right, we're out of time.
Out of time.
So we're going to hear from some of our supporters, and we'll be back shortly. You're listening to Money and Mission on Holy Family Radio.
Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio, WHYF AM 720, where each week we talk about wealth management built on a foundation of biblical wisdom and principles. I'm James.
And this is Eric. And we have been spending this episode talking about individual retirement accounts. And right before the break, James just ran through a list of flavor of ice creams of these IRAs.
And that's right.
Let's see if we can unpack that a little bit for our listeners.
Yeah. Well, again, and, you know, I think we should, we'll probably cover this for a couple of weeks, right? Because as we said, the documents, I mean, the IRS booklets that talk about IRAs altogether are like over 130 pages long. So there's a lot to talk about there. And we'll probably like stay on this topic until they throw us off. You know, if they show up and say, stop talking about IRAs now. Okay. So, but yeah, so we said there were seven kinds of IRAs and possibly more, but that's what I could think of. So traditional IRAs, Roth IRAs.
Which we spent most of the show talking about so far.
So far, that's mm-hmm. right. Education IRAs, SEP IRAs, simple IRAs, which are not simple, right? There's a lot of rules. SARSEP IRAs and beneficiary IRAs.
Right, and each one of those IRAs have a separate set of rules, right?
They do. Mm-hmm. That's right. This is where we could spend the rest of the year talking about that. But we've already been told to keep it to an hour today.
So who might be eligible for those special types of IRAs and how do they differ from those two common ones?
Yeah. So education IRAs. Well, first, it's important to remember that there are income limits and contribution limits to each kind of IRA. So we won't try to get into, you know, the minutiae of that here today, but just note that the purpose of an education IRA is to save up money so that whoever is the beneficiary of that might be able to use those dollars for qualified education purposes at some point in the future. So, you know, many people have probably heard of education accounts, Section 529 mm-hmm. accounts. Well, an education IRA is similar in that people put money into that IRA to save up money for somebody's education. And then when the student arrives at a point where they're drawing money out for qualified education purposes, then they get special tax treatment as long as they're using the money for its intended purpose like that. So that's an education IRA. A SEP IRA is really, a SEP stands for Simplified Employee Pension. But a SEP IRA really is intended and is designed for people who are self-employed. Hmm. So, you know, if somebody's a real estate agent or a consultant or some self-employed person like that, then gets to make a higher contribution as a percentage of their income.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, again, that's kind of a tricky rule. So we always really advise people to make sure that they're working with a qualified financial planner and a CPA to make sure that they are getting the best contribution they're maximizing their contribution tax efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So simple IRAs are designed for employers who have less than 100 employees. And people can make either a percentage of their income as a contribution to that or a fixed dollar amount. But again, there's caps. There's a limit of how much can be contributed to that simple IRA each year. And don't memorize the limit because, again, it seems like it changes.
We've stopped.
That's right, yeah. So, but one of the places, well, in a couple minutes, we'll get to places where you can go to find more information about IRAs, including limits on contributions and so on. SARSEPs really are kind of a dinosaur, if you will. SARSEPs were the predecessor to simple IRAs. And there, again, it was designed for small employers, but it was built on the same percentage of income contribution as a SEP was. Again, it was just designed for small employers. I believe it was employers who had 25 or fewer employees. But it's been a number of years since RCEPs were available. You still find some of them hanging out there, but most employers who are in that space, if you will, are using simples today instead of RCEPs. Beneficiary IRAs are simply a way of a beneficiary who, or someone who is named as the beneficiary on someone else's IRA, now receives that money, but then there are specific rules about how quickly the money that was in the IRA needs to be distributed. And that's based on the IRA, on the beneficiary's age. And that's all that we'll say for now, because that could be a week-long discussion all by itself. So
all these different plans and all these different rules, it sounds like it can get complex, huh?
Oh, very, very quickly. That's right. That's right. So, you know, again, at the risk of redundancy, you know, we always really just, you must be advised to make sure you're working with qualified advisors to help navigate through those rules. So,
right. But remember, it's just a tool, right? Each one of those.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I mean, because the complexity of that can kind of be really scary and
sure.
But it is a tool. An IRA is a tool. And the money that's in that tool, that the tool represents, can help you accomplish your goals. It can help you move on the path to this mission that God has called you to in your life.
Mm-hmm. So those are all the different IRA accounts that one can hold. What sort of investments can you hold inside of those buckets, like you said earlier?
Oh, wow.
How much time we got left, Joe?
that's right. How much time? Yeah, we want to make sure that we leave at least a couple minutes to reference, you know, places where you can go to find information. But let's dive into what you can invest in. And you know, this becomes very interesting. If you would go to a bank and set up an IRA, you would probably have your money be in a bank product then. And bank products tend to be things like certificates of deposit. So it's possible that, let's say, you went to a bank and you set up an IRA and the folks at the bank put you in a certificate of deposit, and maybe you're just earning an interest rate like 4% or something like that. You might conclude, wow, you know, if I set up an IRA, it's something I do at the bank and I get 4%. But if you're looking for growth,
it's not going to give you that.
It's not going to give you that. You could reach really an incorrect conclusion, because the only experience you ever had with an IRA is whatever you got at the bank.
Mm-hmm. So like mutual funds then?
Well, yes. Mutual fund companies are eligible institutions, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So they're eligible. The IRS has deemed them eligible to set up these tax-preferred savings accounts. But if you do that at a mutual fund company, then you're going to have an IRA that's invested in mutual funds.
Right.
Right.
I'm not going to sell you another bank CD.
That's right. So now your IRA is going to perform just like whatever mutual funds you just bought inside of that IRA, which again could lead to an erroneous conclusion. Like, let's say that you invested in a mutual fund in an IRA right at the very beginning of 2020. And a month later, the market caves in because COVID comes along. You could conclude, oh my goodness, this IRA thing is not for me because I just lost a ton of money. You know, I had all this fluctuation in my IRA. But that wasn't the fault of the IRA. That was because you owned an investment that fluctuated
with the market.
That's mm-hmm. right. So, yeah, so we look at all these different possibilities, things you could be invested in, and we think it's important to know that different kinds of IRAs have different investments. So I'll hit just a couple more things, and we'll need to pick up on this next week, but you could have a brokerage account as well. There are things called self-directed IRAs, and yes, you're correct. Things get very complicated very quickly. That's right. But, you know, some places you can go to find good information on IRAs. One of the best places, depending on your definition of best, is to go to www.irs.gov. www.irs.gov. And correct, you will be on the IRS's website. In the search field at the top right-hand corner of the page, you can type in the number 590.
Publication 590.
Publication 590. You type that in, and when you hit enter, then several links will come up for you to choose from. One link will say Publication 590A. Mm-hmm. Publication 590A contains all the rules, or I guess as many rules as they could fit in a publication, related to making IRA contributions.
So A is money coming in.
A is money coming in. Mm-hmm. That publication is 61 pages long. Publication 590B is all about money going out. Mm-hmm. The rules related to distributions. That is 69 pages long. The IRS updates those publications each year. So if you really want to stay on top of it, you know, about June of every year, you can hop out to the IRS's website and read the updated publication 590.
It's melatonin and a publication 590.
That's right. But, you know, the IRS doesn't, you know, is not in the business of producing sales material or something. Mm-hmm. So you'll be reading the rules. And we'll talk more about this next week as well. It's just fascinating how time flies by when you have this kind of an interesting topic to be looking at. But again, remember, in spite of the complexity, an IRA is a tool. Money, and in general, is a tool.
That's right.
It's a test, and it's a testimony as well. So we'll look forward to being with you again next week.
That's right. We're all out of time for this week's show. We will pick up next week. This has been great, James. Thanks for all the information. You have been listening to Money and Mission here on Holy Family Radio.